Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 23, The World According to Tom Norton. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. It's time to geek out with our guest geek of the week, Tom Norton, senior editor and video technical editor of Home Theater Magazine and blogger on UltimateAVMag.com, my own website. Hey, Tom, welcome to the show.
Hey, good afternoon, Scott.
I want everybody to know up front, those of you who are watching the live stream and listening to what we're doing as we're doing it, that I invite you to submit some questions in the chat room. Because this is a rare opportunity to ask one of the preeminent AV journalists in our industry to ask him some questions about whatever you like in the realm of audio and video, because Tom is equally well-versed in both areas. So I just wanted to make sure that everybody knew that. So I want to start, Tom, by congratulating you on your 20th anniversary this month, I believe.
Yes.
More or less.
Technically speaking, it was March, but it's one of these strange things. I first came to work at Stereophile in March of 1990, but I didn't actually move to Santa Fe where Stereophile was located until June. So I guess technically it's 20 years based on residency.
Now, for 20 years, you've been working for the publisher of Stereophile magazine, which is what you first started writing for. And then later moved on to Home Theater, which was at first called Stereophile Guide to Home Theater.
Right.
Actually, that's not true. UAV, Ultimate AV, was originally Stereophile Guide to Home Theater. Home Theater magazine was originally published by a different company and bought by the company that publishes Stereophile. So in all of these machinations, you have been writing about audio and video for longer than the last 20 years, but 20 years for the company that publishes 20, all these
20 years as a full-time employee for a company that publishes information on those topics. Yes.
Now, before that, I didn't know this, but when we were talking before the show and getting ready for the show, you actually published your own little publication there for a little while.
That was fun. That was back in the era when there were what were called underground audio publications. Even then, Stereophile was considered an underground stereo publication, meaning that they had like 2,000 or 3,000 readers.
Right. Now, Stereophile's been around for what, 35, 40 years?
Stereophile's been around since I think 63 or 64, somewhere in that time frame. Yeah, but it was quite an erratic publishing schedule until Larry Archibald bought it in the early 80s and decided to make it 8 times a year, and then it went to 12 times a year, and now it's one of the major magazines in the field, of course.
Seriously, yeah, seriously. Now, you originally started as an audiophile, so you were writing about speakers and amplifiers
and sources and anything else you can name. Yep.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I find it very interesting that even now, even today, you're contemplating building your own speakers.
Well, it's just an experiment. Let's not go into that in too much depth right now until we see what happens. and to be honest, it's not. They are not speakers based on my design. Anyone can go online and research speaker building of various types, do-it-yourself audio, and find all kinds of people that work on that sort of stuff and spend an awful lot of time on it. Many of them appear to be as competent at it as most speaker designers that work in the industry. So, except that they work radically, like as they have other jobs, so they don't have a time to. They may take them years to get a design completed.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll look forward to in some amount of time, and I'm sure you're going to have to be doing it relatively erratically
really,
yourself.
Really erratic schedule, yes.
Because after all, you have a day gig.
Yes, right. But I will probably write about it in a blog at some point. So
right. Good. We're going to talk about that blog in just a minute. But we've already got our first listener question from Battlestar Jeff, who asks, is Macintosh gear still good?
Certainly, it's very good stuff. I mean, Macintosh has always made good equipment, reliable equipment. They don't get quite as much play in the audiophile press as other brands do. They never did, because I never think that they didn't really go in for reviews that much. We've done some reviews. I did a whole series of Macintosh reviews of a home theater system back in the late 90s, one of their first attempts at home theater. And they went all the way from speakers to pre-pros and amplifiers, and they still make pre-pros and amplifiers, and I believe multi-channel amps. But you don't read about them much in the publication because they tend to be very expensive. Though there are certainly more expensive stuff out there that but they also do cater to. They've always catered to a fairly exclusive market, so they apparently don't feel they need the kind of reviews the smaller manufacturers that are less well known need to get themselves on the map.
Right, right. Do they still make speakers? I didn't even know they ever did.
Oh, yes, they do. Oh, yes, they do. They make speakers. Yep.
Huh. Something I know that Krell also makes speakers, and I've always found that to be a bit odd.
Well, Krell started, actually, just like Macintosh, Krell didn't make started with electronics, and that's where they made their name, and that's where they have their main name. But their dealers do sell Macintosh speakers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned the blog on ultimateavmag.com, and I want to point everybody to your blog on our site right now, because you're engaged in a multi-part evaluation of a bunch of Blu-ray players. Why don't you tell us how you're conducting that evaluation?
Well, it's been apologize for anyone that's been following. It's been dragging on for some time.
Hey, you got a day gig.
Well, that's part of my day gig, I guess you could say. But I did post a number of entries for it a couple of months back, and it's actually 80% done. I still have a couple of more things to check out. But it's basically, even though I did evaluate the video of the players subjectively, may still do some tests on processing. I haven't done that yet. But it's mainly on the audio playback quality of various Blu-ray players.
Because we found, I think you would agree, that the video quality of Blu-ray players is there's only a hair's difference between them, if any.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, there's some very, very subtle differences, but they fall in the realm of, did I really see that, or am I imagining what I'm seeing? So yes, I did. I did comment on differences between different players, but as I think I pointed out in one of the last pieces I wrote on the subject, I wouldn't use that as a deal breaker when I'm evaluating it. Which Blu-ray player to purchase? I mean, the video is the least of your concerns.
The audio is more processing.
Processing is another issue. I mean, how well does it upconvert various formats? I mean, that's something that many people are concerned with. I haven't tested that on these players yet because, again, the main thrust of it was audio. I think before I part with them, I'll probably run some basic processing tests, and that'll be one of the last things to be done.
But I think that's a good idea, particularly because a lot of people have DVDs, a lot of DVDs,
right.
And
that's
if they're going to upgrade their player to a Blu-ray player, they want to know that it's going to do a good job on the DVDs as well.
That's true. And again, one of those, that's another reason that's important is it's one of the subject reasons for this piece is to cover audio in more detail than most reviews of Blu-ray players do. Can I replace, they want to know, can I replace my CD player with a Blu-ray player and get the kind of quality I expect to get out of it? And I found that yes, in most cases you can. The differences are fairly subtle, and they're in the audiophile way. They're important to some people. They may not be important to others. I found differences between them. They've already been discussed in the blog, and anyone that wants the details can go into the blog. I've already discussed the differences in analog outputs. The one player that I have not yet tested the analog outputs yet that's due, that I do is due for the for an update, is the special edition of the Oppo BDP-83. I've done the
standard, which has upgraded analog audio outputs.
Upgraded analog audio outputs, but as otherwise, according to Oppo, otherwise identical to the BDP-83, the standard model. So if someone was not going to use the analog audio outputs, there would probably be no compelling reason to spend the extra $200 or $300 that it costs.
Mm-hmm. Have you spent any time comparing the analog outputs to the HDMI output?
That I haven't done, mainly because I never listen to music through the HDMI outputs. I only use it for video, for movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a school of thought that says that the HDMI outputs don't work well with audio only, that you should use either the analog outputs or the SPDIF, which is your standard digital output, preferably the coaxial, to get the best quality out of any of these players. And that's one thing I need to test yet on the players is the digital output from the from the digital outputs themselves. And at that point, I may do a couple of checks on the HDMI outputs as well, just to see if this particular school of thought, which doesn't like using the HDMI outputs for audio, for pure audio, whether there's any, how much validity there is to that, and how important it is.
Yeah. What was the other question I was going to ask? Oh, before we get to some reader questions or listener questions, which we now have several, I just wanted to quickly ask, you mentioned that between the optical and the coax digital audio outputs, preferably, you said preferably coax. Why is that?
That's again something that's I guess you could say in a way it's maybe an audiophile mantra. You don't want to use the optical outputs of a CD, Blu-ray, DVD player for the best quality audio. You always want to use the coaxial outputs.
And what's the rationale for that?
I think it has something to do with bandwidth, but it goes back so far, it's in the mists of audiophile lore. But I mean, that is a concern to some, because there are some Blu-ray players that don't have coaxial digital outputs. Most of the Pioneer players, for instance, except for their top of the line BDP09, most of them just have optical. They just have coaxial optical outputs.
Just have coaxial, you mean?
Yes, there was a time in the audiophile era about 15 or 20 years ago when some of the manufacturers that were into the highest quality, for instance, Mark Levinson, as an example, there was actually a special form of optical output. I can't recall what it was called, but it's not the standard type toslink output that we all see today. And it was a completely different format of optical output, and I haven't seen that in about 10 or 12 years. I think it's kind of lost. There were never that many manufacturers that used it, and it's kind of disappeared from the market, as far as I can tell. Though it's possible that some really high-end esoteric gear that I haven't seen may still have it.
Yeah.
Obviously, you'd have to have it not only on the player, but you'd have to have it on the input of your preamp or pre-pro, and there are no pre-pros that I know of that have it, but there may be some high-end preamps that do.
Right, exactly. Paul C. UK asks, are those four color sharp TVs just a gimmick, or is there more mileage in four color?
Well, we haven't tested one yet, so I don't want to diss them too hard for coming up with a nice marketing gimmick with George Takei as their spokesperson.
Those are great ads. I love those commercials.
Terrific ads. But so you give them credit for that much, and for creating a new thing to be concerned about in the era that when everyone is concerned about 3D, pretty much, and not to the exclusion of everything else. I know we were all the press at Assemble Press at CES with everyone talking up their 3D and their press events, and all of a sudden we walked into Sharp and they're talking about four color and ignoring 3D entirely. We said, what?
It's a bit of a yawn factor there.
Well, what it does essentially, if you use it the way it's designed to be used, the way they designed it, and probably the way it comes out of the box, it's another example of a too wide color gamut. Basically,
color gamut being the range of colors that the TV can reproduce.
For instance, you've got a range of red, green, and blue, and whatever falls within the range that red, green, and blue allows. If you read our reviews, we have a CIE, what you call a CIE chart, which shows the color gamut of that we measure on each set. And there's a standard for that for high def. It's called Rec 709, sometimes called BT 709. If you fall outside that standard, all sources are designed or should be made to that standard. And if you fall outside of that standard, you're winding up with an inaccurate color. Now it may be a very pleasant color. You may like it. That doesn't mean people aren't going to look green or anything like that. But it's an exaggerated color, and it's let's say more real than real.
I always say that because the content is produced with a certain color gamut, then the display should reproduce the same gamut. And if it reproduces a wider gamut, such as four color displays are likely to do, then it's in fact inaccurate, as you say.
That's right. For instance, if you look at the pure green on the color, the pure green on the color gamut, on the chart that I referred to, the CIE chart, if you look at the point of green, and you look at the point of green on some displays where they actually move the green point further beyond that point. If you feed a signal that has that exact same green into it, it's not going to be the green that the source required. It's going to be some other exaggerated green, and you can carry that through to blue and red and everything in between that's a mixture of those colors, and you wind up with basically a distortion of the color that that was intended by the source. If you're talking about a movie, the color that the colorist or the director, if the director was on hand during the transfer, the source that the color that the director wanted you to see. Obviously, your display has to be properly calibrated for all this to happen as well, and many displays aren't. But right. One of the problems with displays is that they tend to go beyond the standard color gamut. Some displays do offer the chance to offer controls. We call it a color management system. That's what generally is referred to as. They offer the controls that allow this to be corrected in the set. Well, it cannot be corrected by the user. You have to have very sophisticated test gear to do it. The user should stay away from that system. If they just want to play, they shouldn't mess with it. They can't damage their set by using it, but they can't make it right either unless they have the right gear.
Right, and training as well.
And training. But when you get to back to the color, what's happening with the extra yellow point that's added by Sharp. First off, they have to create that yellow in the set. The yellow is not in the source. The source has red, green, and blue, and that's all. And luminance intensity. It has red, green, and blue, which are a combination of combined create the intensity. But red and green are combined in the set to create yellow. Well, what Sharp has decided is, well, we're going to have yellow pixels and we're going to create this yellow inside the set, but we're going to feed this specifically to the yellow pixels instead of to a combination of the red and the green pixels. We'll feed it to our yellow pixel. And the reason we want to do this is that means we can push the yellow out further beyond the standard to give you a bright, brilliant yellow. Well, for the reasons that we both just talked about, it's not an accurate yellow. And the question is, if that yellow were exactly where it belongs on the CIE chart, is the technique that Sharp uses, will that create a more realistic yellow, even assuming it's accurate? And one of the things I like to do with the Sharp when we get one of the Sharp sets in for review, and hopefully we will shortly, is to measure it and look at it the way it's set up. We always check get the grayscale correct, the color gray from low to bright.
Black to white, yeah.
Black to white, that's a different issue than the color gamut. Get the grayscale right, and then spend some time watching the set and seeing, commenting on how the yellow looks, and then go into there. They have a fairly thorough, at least it appeared from the press event, I went to a fairly thorough color management system, which allows you to move all these color points around, including yellow. Mm-hmm. And if possible, move that yellow point to where it's supposed to be. In other words, you're moving to where it's supposed to be. While the yellow is still being produced by the yellow pixels, instead of a combination of the red and green pixels,
right?
It's being produced by that. So and then switch back into, there would be a way to switch back and forth. I won't go into that now; it's too much detail. But switch back and forth and find out if that yellow, when it's in the right place. The yellow, like my shirt here.
it'll be interesting to see what happens when you are on one of those TVs. Yeah,
it's not an homage to Sharp, but anyway, move the yellow to the point where it belongs. And see what it looks like. And it theoretically, maybe if for some reason that we can't describe, it might look better than the combination of red, green, and blue, where it puts yellow at the correct point. But we'll have to wait and see exactly what that does. When you know, as delivered, it will give you an exaggerated yellow, just as all these color points move beyond their correct location, will give you an exaggerated color. And if that's the case, well, then it's going to be a matter of, you know, do I prefer this to an accurate picture? We don't generally.
Yeah. No, I prefer an accurate picture. Thank you very much.
For an accurate picture, but I can see where some people in the marketplace might like the look, and I'm not going to criticize them for liking that, except that they're not getting an accurate picture.
Right. Exactly. Dr. Fate asks, is the new Mitsubishi DLP TV with added built-in 3D capability worth the upgrade? Now, I will say first that this is not new with Mitsubishi DLP TVs. They have had 3D capability for several years, really. They were among the first in the market, along with Samsung, when they were making rear projection TVs, to have that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it worth the upgrade? I guess if you're going to buy
the upgrade, does that mean he already has a Mitsubishi TV? And is it his question is if he I'm assuming he already has the Mitsubishi TV. The question is, how old is it? It may already have the 3D capability built into it. It may only require an upgrade of an external box of some type that apparently Mitsubishi will market that allow you to plug your 3D Blu-ray player into the box, The box plugs into the TV. The box converts the 3D in the player that comes off the player. The disc, which is not the same format as the Mitsubishi is designed to handle, but it converts it so that the Mitsubishi can display it. Was it worth it? I can't say that for sure since we haven't looked at that. I mean, I would really, that's the situation where I'd really like to see what it does before commenting on how well it does it.
Now, I have to say that at CES, I don't know if you made it to the Mitsubishi demo, which was in the back of the central hall.
I missed
hall.
That. They were hiding in the back.
They were hiding in the back. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Fairly small booth, and they had a trailer there. Yeah,
it was actually a trailer. Yeah.
Yeah. I did go buy it one day, but I didn't get into it because I got distracted by something else, so I didn't get in to see it. So I wished I had at this point. But yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I did see it, and it looked pretty good. I was pretty impressed. Mm-hmm. Among the interesting things about it was they were using active shutter glasses, as virtually all 3D flat panels are using as they come out into the market this year. They were using what's called DLP Link. Most of the flat panel TVs that we're seeing this year have an infrared beam that comes out of the TV, hits the glasses, and synchronizes their flashing on and off alternately right eye, left eye.
Yep.
Whereas the Mitsubishi TVs are using what's called DLP Link, which flashes a white frame on the screen once in a while, and the glasses sync to that instead of an IR beam.
Interesting. We actually heard about that 2 weeks ago. We went to an event at Stewart Film Screen that included folks from Digital Projection, and they used they use DLP in their projectors, and they were talking about that particular form of energizing the shutter glasses.
Right, exactly. Yep. Exactly. Let's see.
Apparently that only works with DLP because of the way the technology is designed. You can't use it with flat panel. So
apparently not. I mean, I don't see why you couldn't. I mean,
it could be designed to flash the correct white at the correct point to switch the glasses, but
TG Fryer asks you, was it a large stretch to become video centric, especially since your background goes back to working with audiophiles?
Not at all. I mean, I developed an interest in higher quality video back in the early 80s. So my first decent TV was a Sony 21-inch Profil monitor.
I remember those.
21-inch was a big TV back then. And in fact, I still had that set when I left Santa Fe in the year 2000. I hadn't used it for about 5 or 6 years, but I did use it up until the mid-90s. Until I started getting into, you know, formal video reviews, it had a lot of limitations. It was strictly composite input. It didn't even have an S-video input, no components.
Oh, man.
Nobody had ever heard of component in the early 80s.
Right.
So, but it did produce an excellent picture. I mean, of course, it was something I never calibrated. I didn't know from calibration in the early 80s. No one did. The tools to do it, in fact, really probably were pretty primitive if they existed at all at that time.
Right.
Strictly in the professional area, they probably cost a fortune. Of course, they also do. They still cost a fortune today.
those professional monitors. I mean, Sony's. I forget the model number, but they have had a monitor for professional studios, Color Labs, and so on, that was used for many, many years and very expensive.
Yeah, well, this was designed. I mean, this was a TV monitor with a separate tuner.
Tuner.
Upward tuner, and of course, the only other sources at the time were Laserdisc, and I didn't get into that for about 2 years, but I did. I mean, a couple of years later, I bought a Laserdisc player, and I had started a collection of Laserdiscs in the mid-80s. Mm-hmm. So my interest in video certainly doesn't predate my interest in audio, but my interest in movies does. And so that's a form of video. So I guess you could say my interest in audio was triggered by my interest in movies.
Yeah. I remember when you lived in Santa Fe, you used to take all your vacations to L.A. in order to go to the really nice theaters here,
at
movie
least once
theaters
a year,
here in L.A.
At least once a year, I'd spend 5 or 6 days in L.A. because the theaters in New Mexico were so terrible. You know?
Now, I should also mention that to everybody that you have a very technical background. You spent, 20 years in the Air Force as an engineer?
An engineer and a pilot.
And a pilot, yeah, you're a pilot as well.
Pilot,
flying
pilot,
fighter craft and transport planes, very
transport,
interesting.
Yes.
Yep. But you're also an electrical engineer.
Yes, well, trained electrical engineer. I went into the Air Force out of college and really didn't use it per se, except when I got into more technical fields in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. But that was after your pilot days, huh?
Yeah. Yes, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. let's see. Somebody who didn't put their own name in said, what are the advantages besides being thin of LED TVs? Doesn't this just pertain to the backlight of an LCD screen?
You're referring to ultra, you know, of course, all LEDs are thin. I mean, all current sets are relatively thin. I think you're referring, is the listener referring probably to the really thin five panel TVs?
Well, he's asking is, what are the advantages of LED TVs? And I think this is actually a great question. He's saying, doesn't this just pertain to the backlight of an LCD screen? And the answer is yes, it does.
Yes, it does.
And
yes, it does.
The term LED TV per se is perhaps a bit misleading.
It's misleading. It still bothers me. I can understand why, you know, my manufacturer would do it, because they're using it. It's basically a marketing, you know, an interesting marketing approach. But yeah,
on the other hand, saying LED backlit or edge lit LCD TV is a little more of a mouthful.
It's kind of cumbersome. Yeah.
But, yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, and there is no such thing as an LED TV. If you're by LED, you refer to the LEDs actually creating the image themselves. They don't do that.
Right. They're just the backlight.
That would take 6 million LEDs, you know, 2 million per color.
Right. So, right.
Have an awful lot of LEDs. It would be a rather expensive set.
Now, if you go to Vegas and you see some of those big, giant animated signs outside the casinos, or the Fremont Experience, the overhead thing on Fremont Street, that is a true LED TV in a sense.
Some of them are actually light bulbs.
Really?
If they're large enough, they use colored light bulbs. Yeah, they're programmed. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's true. Okay.
Just imagine the cost. I mean, LEDs. The LEDs are all fairly small that I know of, and that would be fairly very expensive to have a 20-foot sign with just, you know, millions and millions of LEDs in it, versus, you know, 5,000 light bulbs or something like that. But I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on outside lighting, but I believe they use. The smaller ones probably use LEDs. The bigger ones probably use strictly light bulbs, because they're brighter than LEDs, if nothing else. You want a really bright sign.
Yeah, LEDs are getting pretty bright these days.
Yeah. But the advantages of LEDs are, I mean, the big advantage of LED is not necessarily in color, because the other technologies have given us decent color on sets. Color is not, once it's calibrated correctly, and I'm assuming the manufacturer gives you the opportunity or the controls you need to calibrate it properly. Mm-hmm. Once it is calibrated properly, you know, the color difference between sets are there, but I don't think any of them are deal breakers. And some people might disagree. I don't think they are, but LEDs give you the opportunity for not necessarily better color, but better control over things like black levels.
Right. In particular, backlit, LED backlit. And we should say that there are two types of LED illuminated TVs, one in which the LEDs are behind the LCD panel, and one in which they ring, they are at the edge of the screen. They're ringing the LED LCD panel. And each of those offers their own advantages.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But the LED, the one that gives you the best so far, that gives you the best black levels you can get from an LCD set, are the LED backlit, which use local dimming.
Right.
So they have the clusters are located of LEDs are located behind the screens, and they can dim various areas of the screen selectively depending on how dark that part of the picture needs to be, or they can shut them off completely when the picture goes dark. Anyone that's seen some of them, not all, but some of the LED backlit sets are safe when they fade to black and the room is dark enough, you just lose any sense that the TV is even on. In a sense, it isn't, because the LEDs are all off. The other circuits are still cooking. But whereas edge lit, you can do interesting things to improve the black levels with edge lit, such as, you know, you can modulate all the LEDs at once, which will give you some control. They don't all do that. Some might do it. Some don't. Mm-hmm. But you don't have as many clusters. You don't have specific areas, and it's not quite as easy to get the same quality of local dimming that you can get you can't get local dimming per se from an edge lit set, but you can do other things to improve the black level. But one thing to keep in mind is that LED local dimming, they're not all created equal. Depending on how many clusters are behind the screen, you might get things like, if you got white lettering on a black background, you'll see halos around the white lettering.
Recently, or Starfields.
Starfields, yes. I recently reviewed an LG set. I'm not sure if it's appeared in print or not. It should be very, if it's not, it should be the latest issue or the one upcoming.
It's the LE8500.
Yes, 8500 from LG. A terrific set in every respect, except only on one Starfield. From the beginning of the opening scenes from Stargate Continuum, which has one of the best Starfield tests I've found.
Right.
You actually get about a half a dozen of those brighter stars have clear halos around them.
But I didn't
notice that on any other material to that extent on that particular set. So it wasn't a deal killer, but it did bother me some.
Yeah. I was just watching 2001. A Space Odyssey over the weekend, and on my Kuro Pioneer plasma, and it was very lovely. And I was thinking about how the LED backlit set, those star fields would have looked, could have looked a little strange.
Yeah.
Ken Crayley asks, "What are your favorite Blu-ray titles to watch?"
Wow, I got several hundred. That's a toughie. it depends on what you're looking for. If you're talking about a picture and sound quality, which probably I'm assuming that's the reason for the question. Certainly the best looking, the two best looking titles I've probably seen so far are Baraka, which was boiled down from a 70mm, 65mm, if you want to be technical, print of the original movie.
And scanned at 8K, I believe.
Scanned at 8K, yes. And Avatar is also quite stunning. So if you want the best picture quality, I'd say those are two titles. There's a lot of other good ones. I mean, they vary a lot. I mean, one of the interesting things about evaluating the picture quality of any disc of any video source, and especially including Blu-ray, is and it's always a matter of some controversy, and I've never quite settled on is do you evaluate the quality of the result based on a perfect looking movie, what you would judge a perfect movie, or how well the transfer relates what was originally shot in the movie. In other words, how well does it replicate what the director wanted?
Okay. Right. And how can we really know that?
How can we know that? That's the problem. So we often wind up evaluating movies on the first basis that I mentioned. How pristine does it look? Mm-hmm. And of course, that creates problems with studios when they get complaints about like grain. They may do things like add noise reduction to eliminate grain, and that's been a very sore point with a lot of people, especially if you look at some of the internet postings and stuff like that. They'll scream bloody murder when they see what looks like a too smooth and glossy looking image. Mm-hmm. It doesn't happen all the time. I'm sure there's always a little bit of grain removal going on, and on a lot of titles because grain is hard to it basically eats up a lot of bits. You're trying to process a movie. You're trying to it all uses heavy amounts of video compression, and video compression is hard to do properly if you've got a lot of very 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 small details, and grain is actually
as it gets.
Very very small detail. So
right,
some of
right.
it is probably gone, but there should be enough to basically reproduce what the director's intent was, if you could know that, and hopefully the director might be on hand. That's not true with a lot of old movies, of course, but older movies which tend to have more grain because the film had more grain back then.
Right. But some directors and producers choose a particular film stock because of the grain.
That's right. Yeah.
And so they want to keep that in there.
Yeah, there are some movies, for instance, that may properly reproduce what the director intended that actually, for some of us, don't look that good, or we don't particularly like the style of that director or that cinematographer, but that's not our decision to make.
Right. I've gotten a couple of questions here about OLED.
Okay.
And I don't know if you saw this in the last few days. I've been getting a couple of news items about, I've forgotten who it is now, is starting to make noises about larger LEDs, OLEDs.
OLEDs?
Yeah.
Would have to be maybe Samsung or someone like that. I'm not sure. But
Samsung or LG, I think. It was one of the two.
Of course, we know that
up till now, OLED has been used in very small screens for smartphones and little viewers and stuff like that.
Yep.
But ramping it up to real home theater sizes has been prohibitively expensive and difficult to do. Have you heard anything else about OLED lately?
Nothing more. I mean, obviously, a couple of years ago, I took a look at Sony's little 11. It's 11-inch, I believe, OLED, and it was, you know, it was a gorgeous-looking picture. Of course, at 11 inches, it's hard to pick out flaws.
Yeah, right.
I think I called it the world's best tummy television. Probably the world's most expensive tummy television.
And
as well.
Of course, yes, it was $2,500.
And I don't know, but I'm not sure, but they may still sell that. I don't know. They haven't shown it. They didn't show it, I don't believe, at last year's CES. It had been a huge crowd pleaser at a CES a couple of years ago. They had a bunch of them sitting there, but since they decided they're not going to really go forward with it very much right now, apparently they've kind of quieted down on it, but they may still market it. But yeah, you're right. The problem is getting the price. The problem is that with OLEDs, and with the same thing was true with Toshiba's SED, if anyone remember that.
Yes. Which that, recently, I think I saw a news item just last week that said that Canon was finally completely throwing in the towel on SED and just giving up entirely. They had legal problems. Yep. They were partnered with Toshiba and that didn't work out. Yep. And the company that originally developed the technology was suing them. And so they finally said, forget it.
Yeah, SED, for any listeners or viewers that aren't that aren't familiar with the technology, was to make it a complicated technology extremely short. It was basically a whole bunch of little CRTs on a flat panel. Okay,
yeah, like two million CRTs.
Each pixel had its own was driven individually like a CRT would be with a beam of some type. Beam of electrons, yes. And you would they were phosphors, but they would be excited with a beam of electrons instead of with other technology, which is what plasmas operate differently. But,
right, exactly.
But the problem, the issue with SEDs was that it allowed for extremely good black levels.
We saw a few years ago at CES were amazing.
Amazing. Of course, no one knew at the time whether those sets would last for 100 hours or more. You know, they might have lasted for the duration of CES, and then there were a lot of problems. But the biggest problem was they were talking. I remember CES about 3 years ago. They were talking about introducing it at like almost $8,000 for a 50-inch set, and that was when LCDs and plasmas were down around $3,000 to $4,000. And of course, we know what happened. They've gone even down further even since.
Yeah, absolutely.
Basically, you got a new technology that's very expensive. Can it compete against technologies that are out there and that people seem perfectly happy with? And the problem with SED is apparently it couldn't, and that's the same problem with OLED.
Exactly. Yeah. The other news item I read recently was that, I should have done some research on this before the show, but I'll talk about it on Leo's show or something, that some company had developed a printing process whereby OLED material could be printed on a substrate, much like an inkjet printer, which would allow ramping up to these larger sizes.
Yeah, well, I did look into that a couple of years ago, and that's true. There's a lot of technology going on with OLED technology. I mean, a lot of people are looking at that sort of technology for illumination in the home because it's extremely efficient. And though it's apparently still very expensive, you can't go to Lowe's or Home Depot and buy an OLED light bulb. Well, you can buy LED. You buy LED light bulbs,
right?
And we all know they're still pretty expensive. So, but there was a thought that you could create these OLEDs on a flat. You could almost have your wallpaper be your light. Essentially, that's the whole idea. Wallpaper.
Right.
One wall to your room, or as much of your room as you wanted. And throw on a switch, and the wall would light up.
Yeah, that's very cool. Aaron B. asks, how can you tell if your TV is 3D capable? He has a 2-year-old JVC Elcos Rear Pro. I can say with confidence that it is not 3D capable.
It is not 3D capable. If the TV was not introduced this year and is not advertised as 3D capable, it's not 3D capable.
Exactly.
Now, again,
going back to Mitsubishi, they've had 3D sets actually for the last three or four years.
Mitsubishi is the exception. Yeah.
Right. But other than Mitsubishi, if it wasn't announced this year, and if the manufacturer didn't put 3D all over the box.
That would certainly be. I mean, nobody's going to hide that under a bushel.
No.
But if the caller had has a Mitsubishi TV. In that case, I would actually check with the manufacturer. This is the model number. Is it, is it capable of 3D with the adapter that you're going to market? That would be the bottom line on that one.
Right. Exactly right. let's see. Here's Battlestar Jeff again asks, he has a Fujitsu Plasma 42-inch. Interesting. Fujitsu kind of got out of the business there not too long ago. It keeps resetting from both Blu-ray and a new Tivoli back to 480i every night. What can I do? I don't know.
I don't know either. I mean, what you mean? The set resets or
yeah, apparently so.
Get a hold of Mitsubishi. I mean, Fujitsu, the set. I mean, they would, I think they're certainly obligated to perform any maintenance on it if there's a problem. I mean, I would contact Fujitsu, even though they don't make TVs anymore. I'm not sure exactly who you'd contact at this stage, but I'm sure if you get a hold of the last address, they might actually have, or a dealer that used to handle Mitsubishi. If you bought it through a dealer, go back to the dealer and find out, I've got a problem. Fujitsu. What do I do about it? Fujitsu, I'm sorry. Yeah. If what can I do about the Fujitsu problem? Because they certainly still have maintenance facilities for the sets. It's only been 2 years since they left the business.
Paul C. asks, will there be displays that are not on a screen? I think he's asking about holodecks.
Well, you know, that's the next thing after 3D, I guess.
yeah, exactly.
I just have to have something new to sell, so look for your 2020 holodeck TV. Okay.
Yes, right. I wanted to talk a bit about, and we don't have much more time, you did an evaluation of two different Stuart front projection screens.
Yes.
Recently, the Stuart StudioTech 130, which has a slight bit of gain, 1.3 gain, versus the StudioTech 100, which has a completely unity gain. We wanted to see what the difference was between them, whether a little gain was a good thing or not. What did you find?
I found that basically the gain is a separate issue. From, you know, the gain depends on whether you need the gain depends on your projector and the size screen you plan on using. I mean, that's the bottom line on that. And also depends on, with the StudioTech 100, Scott, you know, we both know that they don't market that for general use.
Right. That is a very specialized screen. You need to use it in a very dark room, essentially a black hole.
Yeah, with not just the room darkened, but the very little reflection in the room. I mean, if you've got lighter walls, that's not the screen you want. Because the light off the screen will the light is any screen is designed to, well, the kind of screens we're talking about, the two of the year, is designed to reflect, basically diffuse the light in all directions.
Right. Now, the more gain you have, the more the light is concentrated
toward the center.
Directly back, perpendicular to the screen plane, back to the seats.
Yeah. Screens don't really do have any gain. They're not active devices, but they it's where they focus the light is what makes them. They take what light they get and they focus it toward the center, which makes, if you're sitting in the center, makes it brighter. We speak of gain. But the StudioTech 130
which is why you need gain for a particularly large screen and or a particularly dim projector.
Yeah, well, that's basically why Stuart has marketed, still markets, though, to a lesser degree than they did 5 years ago, their Firehawk screen, which basically focuses the light toward the center. It doesn't have a high gain, but it's comparable to the screens we're talking about. But it focuses the light toward the center, so you get less reflections off the side walls. And that was one of the reasons. And plus, it tends to provide better black levels with projectors that don't have particularly good blacks to start with. It minimizes the losses from poor blacks on a projector. That's less of a consideration now than it was 5 years ago because the blacks are getting better on a projector, but it's still a consideration for if you have, say, white walls.
Right.
You might want to consider a Firehawk screen to keep it from the light from bouncing off the wall and back on the screen. But getting back to the 100 and the 130, the 100 is really more of a... It's a specialized screen. You only want to use it in a room that has very little, as we just said, has very little reflection off the walls, and in a room where you're with a projector that has enough light output to fill the screen of the size you want with the bright enough image for you. So that's whereas 130 gives you a slight bit of added gain. I've used a 130 for years, and I'm perfectly happy with it. It has technically, it has a little bit of hot spotting in the middle. That's something I noticed when I took on the measurements I took of the screen that the 100 does not have. but it's not something that I see constantly as I'm watching a StudioTech 130. I know some people that do see it, but it's never bothered me particularly. So yeah, it's if you want the technically the best screen will be something like a StudioTech 100, and there are comparable screens from other manufacturers. I know Jokay makes a particularly good screen for daylight.
The Affinity screen. Also, screen, I believe it's a 0.9 gain.
He's got a 0.9 gain. He's all there working. They were working on a 1.3, but they don't have anything higher gain with that particular screen. They only, right. The highest gain they have right now that I know of is 0.9, which is about the same gain as the Stewart screen.
As the 100, But to use those screens, you really need a dark colored room with very good light control. Otherwise, there's no point in spending your money on that. We have time for one more question from a Monkey Mind, who asks, do you think that within 5 years or so, all TVs will be 3D capable? This is actually a good question.
It's a good question because it's going to depend on whether 3D catches on.
Yes.
We don't know for sure if it will. I mean, it obviously appears to have caught on in the movie theater.
Yes.
I'm not sure if, again, it still could be a fad. I mean, who knows if...
At home, you mean, or in the theater.
Or in the theater. I mean, basically... you know, there have been some good movies out there that have been in 3D. There's also been a couple of turkeys that have been in 3D. And the question is, are the manufacturer going to come out with a whole lot of turkeys to try and chase the 3D dollars because they charge more money to get into a 3D movie.
Right.
And turn the audience off and the audience is going to go back and say, hey, if half the 3D movies they go to are costing them $5 more to see and they're crummy movies.
With crummy 3D effects.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, not every movie is going to be Avatar because not every movie is going to spend $300 million to make the movie.
But, might as well have been $300 billion, I suppose.
It might as well have been, yeah. But if it catches on, if it stays popular in the theater, I suspect it might get popular at home. The issue is there's a lot of ifs. One is how much program material we're going to get.
Yes.
I don't think we're going to see a lot of it this year, and a lot of it's going to be tied up in exclusives. If you look, you'll find out a lot of them. For instance, they just announced that Avatar, when it first comes out in 3D, will be exclusively available when you buy a Panasonic 3D TV.
You won't be able to go to Best Buy and buy that disc in 3D.
Best Buy and buy that disc in 3D. You can buy it now in 2D, but when it looks fabulous, but you can't buy it in 3D. So if you if you find out that at the end of the year there's only 8 3D movies out there, you know, you might lose money, lose interest in buying a 3D TV unless you... Now, the good part is that 3D TVs, while they're not the cheaper TVs, I mean, if you're looking at a $1,000 or $1,200 TV, you won't find a 3D TV this year. But if you're looking in the $2,000 to $3,000 range, which is, you know, 3 years ago, that was a cheap flat panel TV, relatively speaking.
Yeah, now it's a little more expensive.
It's still considered, you know, a good deal for a good flat panel display, though. I mean, it all depends on your resources whether you consider that a good deal or not. But $2,000 to $3,000, and if you're planning to go in that price range anyway, there's no downside to getting. If you get a good set, I can't say for sure what's going to happen with every 3D set. We've tested one set so far, the Samsung, which was not only a good 3D set, it was also a good set. So, there were no sacrifices involved with standard picture to get the 3D. So that's important to know.
But yes,
whether or not it will catch on, or whether or not it will stay popular, that's anybody's guess. Again, if they're going to have to come out with more titles, more widely available to consumers. I mean, if I bought a Panasonic, I can only get the two titles that were exclusive to Panasonic or Samsung, and I can only get the two titles that are exclusive to Samsung, I'd be kind of ticked off. Now, eventually those will go off exclusive. I mean, early in 2011, you'll probably be able to buy the Avatar 3D at your local Best Buy. Hopefully, charge a premium for it. That's another question, how much more they're going to charge for the 3D titles. I hope it's not more than a couple of bucks, but I'm not optimistic it's going to be that cheap.
Well, we're out of time. Tom Norton, thank you very much for being on the
show.
Very informative, and I look forward to having you on again in the future.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You bet. Be sure to check out Tom's reviews and articles at hometheatermag.com and his blog on ultimateavmag.com, especially regarding those Blu-ray player tests that he's doing. It's a very long and interesting project. And those two sites are also my online home, so you can find me there as well. You can also email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. And you can also follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. Next week, my guest is scheduled to be Chris Kyriakakis, co-founder of Odyssey, makers of room correction software and all sorts of very interesting audio stuff. So I'm sure looking forward to that, and I hope you'll tune in. Until then... Geek out.